Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nicholas Kapman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com and check us out and get in touch. So today I'm speaking with Mike Martin from Commissioning Agents. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. So before we jump into the topic for today, could you introduce yourself and your background?
Absolutely. So Nick, I'm an engineer at heart. So I grew up in Southern Indiana. And as I was growing up, I worked on my uncle's dairy farm and my grandfather's apple orchard. So I got a lot of rural history background to me. But through school, I loved math and I loved science and wanted to apply those things. And so I always kind of knew I wanted to be an engineer somewhere in my high school days. I decided that I got a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, and I followed that up with an MBA in operations management. So I've got a master's degree as well as a bachelor's degree in engineering, and joined a large pharmaceutical company called Eli Lilly and Company. I worked there for more than three decades in a lot of places. We can talk about those experiences as we go. And retired from there on an early retirement and knew I wanted to work some more, joined CAI, or Commissioning Agents as it's legally called, and started off as a director of program and project management, and then moved my way into current role, which is the CEO's role, taking over from the founder, Bob Chu. So that's a little bit of background on me. You can follow up on any questions you want to explore a little bit more with that.
Yeah. Well, I am interested to hear a little bit more about your career and how you've evolved. So it sounds like your life has been split in half. There's the Lilly days, and now there's the CAI days. So can you paint a picture for me about kind of what the Lilly days look like and what you did there, and maybe fill in that gap with the retirement and how you moved into CAI?
Absolutely. So the Lilly half was 32 years, so I wouldn't call the CAI half quite that long. So, but 32 years of time at one company is, I think, a remarkable thing. It's a great place to work. I really enjoyed that. I started in roles that were directly engineering, so I got to do a lot of very technical things early in my career, designing facilities and systems and building them and maintaining them. So I got a lot of very in-depth, here's how engineering works in a pharmaceutical company. Led me into some project management activities. I had a chance twice to live in Puerto Rico with my family. So we moved in the mid-90s and then again in the mid-2000s. And I was in charge of an engineering operation for a dry products plant, or oral solid dosage form plant there. And then in the mid-2000s, I was there to start up a biotech factory where insulin was to be made. That was a fantastic experience. Later in my career, I was a site head for device manufacturing, making insulin pens and injectable systems for patients around the world. And I got a chance to live in China and build a cartridge factory in China. And I got a chance to live in Ireland and was building a biotech factory in Kinsale, Ireland, down on the south coast when I got the opportunity to retire. So lots of great experiences in there. We could probably talk for an hour about those if you wanted to.
Well, my curiosity is kind of peaking. What would you say were the good and bad parts about the different regions that you lived in? And then I'd like to, after that, kind of jump into your retirement and how you exited.
Sure. Yeah, so goods and bads. I tend to look at the goods. Now, every experience comes with bads, as we probably all know. But those tend to fade away over time, and I remember the good ones. But I'll share some examples of things. I mentioned my background in Southern Indiana being kind of rural and farm-based, because that makes a big difference. So you take that guy from Southern Indiana, and then you move him to Puerto Rico. The way you approach life as you go to somebody else's country and encounter a different culture is really important. And I was raised and taught to be respectful and to ask questions first, not to assume. And so I've tried to live my life in that way. But living in Puerto Rico, my first time living outside the United States, was a very unique thing. Now it's kind of connected to the U.S. in a way, so it wasn't totally foreign, but Spanish language is important and understanding the culture and the people. But the great part of that, very warm culture of people. And we were doing some really hard work together, but the family orientation of the folks that live there, their passion for work and for social activities is just amazing to me. I got very, very good warm memories of my time there and still have friends there to this day, even though that was many years ago. Yeah. Same kinds of things happen in Ireland and in China. You can imagine the China experience was very dramatic for me later in my career.
Dramatic for you? Is that what you said?
Yeah, dramatic. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's very different in a way. So if you'd like to talk about that for a minute, I can.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, I will say that I can connect with you on the Latin culture. So my wife is Brazilian and definitely walking in and understanding that your norms aren't their norms is definitely a good starting point. But when I speak to my family over there and, you know, they always like to know what's America like, is it like what we see on TV and all that stuff. And one of the things that is kind of hidden under everything that I don't think a lot of people think about is the amount of love in the Hispanic culture. I think we're in America a bit more stoic. We're over there crying for happiness and sadness is a very common thing, hugging people, telling them you love them. So it's definitely a really interesting portion.
Similar experiences as you have.
So I do want to focus on leadership management and kind of continue your story. I can imagine what China was like. In your 32 years at Lilly, just from a technical quality and regulatory standpoint, what was kind of the big one, two, three things that you got from that experience that you bring into your current role?
Yeah, so the, let me pick one or two to start with. As I described my background, I'm not a quality expert or a regulatory expert, but all my assignments were connected to those ideas and people and teams that were delivering that. So you imagine that I went to Puerto Rico to start up an insulin manufacturing facility, which was really important to patients and really important to the company. And it was a way to kind of replicate what was being done in Indianapolis and build it in Puerto Rico. Of course, that involved a regulatory submission and a pre-approval inspection and all sorts of preparation for that. And one of the really big lessons for me in that process was how important it was to pass a regulatory inspection, the importance of working 2 or 3 years before that. That's not something you just walk into and say, all right, let's inspect this. You have got to have thought through what are you going to test, prepare, document, explain, and make the facility presentable such that when the inspectors come to give you your pre-approval inspection, that you're ready to answer all the questions. And for me, that was a pretty key learning moment. A second one I might mention to you was in my device manufacturing experiences. I was in manufacturing, so we were making the pens themselves, the parts and assembly of the pens, but those required a development team, a research team, and I worked with that team, the product ideas that were going to be launched to market, you know, a very high-end pen or an electronic delivery device or a pen with memory in it, and all the pre-work and regulatory investigation of how to get that submitted and approved to be used in the market was eye-opening to me. And these aren't drug products. These are devices that also require a regulatory submission and an approval. So I learned in that process that, and that stuff sung to me as a mechanical engineer, because it's gears and racks and pinions and springs. Yeah. But all that stuff still requires the same kind of rigor that you would use for a drug that's being approved and put to the market.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Makes sense. So let's move into your retirement. What made you decide to retire? How long were you retired, and how long did it take until you realized that wasn't for you?
So Nick, that's a good story. So I was working in Ireland, building a very large biotechnology manufacturing facility. I was in charge of that project, very large project. And I had intended to be there with my wife living in Southern Ireland. If you've not been to Southern Ireland, it's a very, very nice, peaceful, pleasant place to live with great people. And about a year into that process, Lilly began to offer early retirement package for employees. And it just so happened that what was being offered lined up perfectly for me financially and then with some personal situations. So my wife's mom has dementia, great lady, very advanced stage vascular dementia now. And at that time, it was advancing rapidly. And it was just harder and harder for us to be away from home when my wife was trying to provide care for her mom. And so this offering to retire early and those situations coincided. And we set aside our chance to live in Ireland for a longer period of time and took the retirement offer and moved back home. Now, I knew, and my wife knew, that I wasn't done working. I love a challenge and I was beginning to look for my next challenge, even through the process of the retirement offering, which I had about a 6-month window to explore the market. I was actually retired for 30 days. So
wow,
not too long. So, but I had already received a job offer before my time at Lilly ended. And I just took just the 1 month off when we got home. So for me, the jump to CAI was a natural one. I was asked to lead a division of a company that really did what half of my career was involved with, which was delivery of projects for life science companies, helping other companies to deliver what I had learned to do in my career. So for me, it was a great next step.
Awesome. Thank you. So now being the CEO, you obviously came in at a different level and now you are where you are. You know, leading and managing a team of CAI size is an important task. So what does leadership and management look like to you?
So those two terms, I think sometimes people use them with certain definitions. And so I might adopt some of what they say, but not all. Sometimes people say management is the organization of things and tasks and systems. And that's true. And leadership is about people. And so I would say to you, for me, leadership is really about not me, but the people that are in the team. And there's nothing about me succeeding that's important in that process. The importance is that other people succeed and that they become bigger, better, stronger individuals, learn new skills. And they look back at those experiences and say, that was cool. And Nick, I can tell you from experience, you know, serving in China or in Puerto Rico or as a site head, I look back at those things. People developed me in those roles. And I look back at the things that I learned and I think I loved that stuff. And people did that for me as a leader. They gave me something hard to do. They committed to me. They coached me. And they challenged me. And that for me is what leadership is meant to be about. It's for me not meant to be this guy's in charge. And so whatever he says goes, that's not the way it works. For me, that's really the key of what leadership is.
Yeah, I would agree. It's interesting because as a leader, some people might think that there is a group of individuals that are put in place to serve that person. And what you come to find out when you're in a leadership role is it's the opposite. You have been put in charge to serve everybody else. And just kind of harping on my religion, you know, Jesus, you know, became a servant to all. So in order to be a leader, you have to serve.
Yeah. So I look at that the same way, Nick, and I appreciate your comment about your belief and your faith. I also live my life that way. But for me, it is about service to other people. There's no better way to describe it than to be a servant leader, trying to help other people succeed and therefore the whole group and team success.
Yeah. Another thing I was thinking about is just when people first enter into leadership and management, I'll speak for myself specifically, but I think a lot of people share this, is you kind of have to fake it till you make it. You feel very unprepared, insecure, and there's a lot of learning. And you know, by definition of learning, it means you had to have made a mistake in order to learn, right? Not always, but in many cases. So from where you are today in a leadership and management capacity, how have you evolved, and what are some of the kind of big lessons that you think people could benefit from?
Yeah, so thinking about leadership, and you use the term fake it till you make it, and I've heard the term, and I understand the concept of it. I don't think it's ever wise to be something that you're not and pretend. I think you need to have some training, development, expertise that gets you close enough, and then take a jump, or, you know, make a leap of faith, or take a risk. And I think that's really what's emphasized in that idea. Because I think if something is given to me or to you too soon in our development, it's a recipe for failure, which really doesn't help me or you in our future. So that's probably one of the things I've been learning about, is people tried to do that for me. There were things given to me that maybe they were on the edge of being too far out in terms of what I had developed and learned, but they helped me with that. And I put my heart into it too. And so I guess that's a learning point that I would offer to all folks that are in leadership, is give some hard, challenging things for people to do, but don't set up somebody for failure. I've seen people in their careers they're begging for this next thing to do, and they probably weren't ready. It was given to them, and if they're not supported in the right way, it sets them up for that didn't go well, and therefore their career kind of, it becomes impacted by that. So I would encourage, that's a learning point for me, watching it, experiencing it, is to, as we lead people and develop them, that we don't stretch them so far that they're doomed to failure. That doesn't help anybody.
Yeah. Well, the picture you painted actually looks like me in my early 20s. So my first job out of college, I was promoted to manager in 11 months, and I had an office of 10 people. And I didn't remain in that role for very long. And then I moved to another role where I was also in charge at that point for business development for a large multinational pharmaceutical engineering firm. And I was in charge in North America, similar thing. So I think my ambition early on definitely put me in a place where, for better or worse, I did fail. And at the same time, I did learn. And I definitely hear your point about, or at least what I heard, is you have to make sure you're ready to make that jump and don't just jump into it for the sake of jumping into it. So for people that are looking into leadership and management, or maybe a new level of leadership and management, how do they figure out that they're ready for that next jump in their career?
Yeah, so I think it always needs to be a jump. I don't want to take away and say that a person's always going to be 100% ready for the thing that they're aspiring to. That's not the way it is. If it is that way, you probably shouldn't take it, because you won't be challenged. So it needs to be a reasonable jump that makes you a little bit nervous and stretches you, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And so how do you make sure that you are ready, I'm ready, or that somebody that you're coaching is ready? I really adopted this idea of mentors, finding people that you trust, not just because they tell you what you want to hear, but they tell you what you need to hear. And so I think exploring career options, and I did this a lot in my career, and thinking about what do I want to do. I've got an engineering degree and an MBA. I wanted to combine those things in my career. So that was always a principle for me. And so I was, like you, pushing for things that I wanted to do early. And perhaps it would have been too early for me, the moments I was looking for those. But I asked a lot of questions. And I asked people, what should I learn about? What should I practice? What am I good at? What am I not so good at? And I tried to then be very reflective or introspective about those things so that I didn't just assume, oh, I think I'm great, therefore I am great, but recognize that there are things about me, still are, that need to be worked on. And a good mentor is a solid way to hear and see that. And I've had some excellent ones in my career that told me what I needed to hear, not just what I wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like there's a story behind one of those experiences that really left a lasting impression. So could you share one of those mentor relationships and kind of the overall impact it had?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and mention this guy's name because I think he deserves that. His name is Steve Gilman. And Steve, throughout my career at Lilly, was a person that I went to for advice several different times. And as I approached this chance to go and work in Puerto Rico a second time in the mid-2000s, a very difficult project and very important for the company, I engaged Steve in that process, and he engaged me. Puerto Rico was interested in having me come back because I'd been there in the mid-90s and really built a set of good, solid relationships. But this was a different assignment and had a lot of implications for the company. So Steve coached me a lot about what was going to be important, what was going to be hard, what I needed to be careful of. And he helped me to find the right way to land that assignment. He didn't just give it to me. That wasn't his role, but he helped me to prepare for it. He helped me to demonstrate I was ready. And while I was there for the next 2 to 3 years, I had regular discussions with him about, hey, I'm having this problem. What have you done with this? Here's what I think I'd like to do. What do you think of that? And he made a big difference in my career. I really appreciate him for it. I've used him well after that job, just a few years ago when I was thinking about interviewing for the CEO role here at this company. I engaged Steve Gilman again. He had been retired from Lilly, and we just struck up our conversations again. And he gave me a lot of advice, a very special mentor relationship. Now, I've got a lot of other ones as well. But as you said, hey, which one is it that you're telling this story about? I would say that was Steve Gilman.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think the mentor relationship can be very similar to parental relationships, meaning, I call it the kind of the Facebook effect is before children, it's all about you. And then you have kids and it's all about them. Right. And it's interesting how the pride shifts. There's before children, there's pride in yourself. And then after you have children, there's pride in them. And I would say that is also something I've experienced as a leader and manager, is as an individual contributor, I always took pride in what I did. But then once you start leading and managing teams, the pride no longer, almost never that I can really think of, is ever about you anymore. It's always about the pride in your people and what they've been able to do. So that's something from a kind of a inward company aspect, but there's also opportunities to do mentorship outside of organizations. So can you share with me any sort of mentoring that you've done either within CAI or outside of CAI?
Yeah, so I would say that when I was at Lilly, that was a core part of what I did. It wasn't just the role that I was in and leading and mentoring the people in my team, but I also engaged at one point during my Lilly career. I think I had 20 or 25 individuals that on a regular basis I was meeting with. They weren't all in the immediate team that I was assigned. And I just felt it was important to lift other people up as much as I could as a human, to teach them about things that I learned, sometimes the easy way, sometimes the hard way, so that they could, you know, be better than I was even. And so that's an experience. And I've tried to do that here in this company as well. And there are people that I encounter through school, through things in social networks, through people at church that I try to advise, help, guide when they want that and need that, the same way that people like Steve Gilman did that for me. I think that's an important aspect of life for any of us, especially as we become leaders and we have influence and we have things to teach and offer, because we've lived a number of years of life that always brings with it great lessons.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can think of, either from an individual contributor standpoint or as a leader and manager, that you would say is kind of your defining moment or something that you really are proud of?
It'd be hard to pick one thing, but if I had to search through things that I was the most proud of, I'm going to give you an example of my work in China. So I went to Suzhou, which is a city about 60 miles west of Shanghai. And I was in charge of building a cartridge factory, a filling factory there. And in that process, that project had a lot of difficulties in it, which is one of the reasons they asked me to go and try to help sort it out. And as I got there and I uncovered that there's a group of people here, very intelligent, assigned to this work, but very inexperienced with the thing that they were trying to get to. A lot of potential, not a lot of practice. And so recognizing that and trying to guide that group of people to achieve something, it was super hard because it's hard to learn and do at the same time under pressure. But wow, when we finished that, that group of people, they were amazing. Not because of me, but because of the hard work they put in. That factory got tours by the Chinese government, who wanted to show off, look at the quality of this facility built here in Suzhou. It's passed its regulatory inspections. When you do this thing called a media fill, which is a proof test for an aseptic filling system. And it passed in its first attempt, which is remarkable for a set of people that had never done that before. And again, Nick, that wasn't about me. That was about them and the exploration of learning and developing. And if I look back at that and I think of all the difficulties that we went through together, I would be probably as proud or the most proud of that set of people who achieved that set of goals, especially with all the learning that they did along the way. It was a very cool experience.
Yeah. And it certainly is something to be said about the yin and yang. There's no happiness without sadness. There's no, you know, enjoyment without pain. There's, I think to that specific story, the pride and the sense of accomplishment gets amplified depending on how difficult the task was at hand.
I think that's a good way to summarize that. It was a super hard task. So I can tell you, Nick, there were days I was insanely frustrated with problems that we were trying to solve, not with the person, but with what the outcomes were. But like I said at the beginning, those things fade away in time. And the thing that you remember is a great team, friendships that were built, funny stories that occur, and really the goal and the excitement of achieving the thing you were assigned. That's what I loved about that the most. And you're right, it had its pain, and it had its positives. And I think you're right. The more pain and difficulty, the better the positive feels.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, in your career, as you've evolved and grown and gone through all these different unique experiences, and you've had mentors that you've benefited from, I found that there's certain mantras, certain cliches, certain nuggets of information that I find myself repeating over and over and over again, because it just had a really impactful, it had a big impact on how I lead, manage, or live my life as a whole. So are there any mantras that you can recall that you find yourself kind of going back to over and over again?
Yeah, there are some. I'll refer to a book that I read early in my career, still a very pertinent book to get today, by a gentleman named Stephen Covey, who's a leadership author. And his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I read that probably in the early 90s. It just, for me, still, you know, 25 years later plus, or 30 year plus years later, it still resonates. And one of the mantras in there that I try to live the most is this idea of seek first to understand, and seek to be understood. And so many times in our lives, we're doing that in the opposite way. Nick, let me tell you what's happening. Yeah. And instead of, hey, Nick, what's going on for you? Tell me what we're struggling with here. Tell me about how do you see this? Try to understand the other person first. And then once doing that, you can express what you want to express. Now, that is super important when you go into a relationship in a culture that you're not familiar with. You jump into Puerto Rico, you jump into China, and you're a Southern Indiana farm person, you know, rural community guy, and suddenly you're in Suzhou, China, which is as big as Chicago. And if you don't seek first to understand and then be understood, you're setting yourself up for a lot of difficulty. So that's one of those mantras that I would probably relay to you.
Yep. I've got that book on my bookshelf too. There was something that is very similar to that I recently heard. Of course, I can't recall who said it, but it's kind of related to that, which is nobody's crazy. And it's interesting because you can look at governmental figures, you know, Mao, Hitler, Stalin, said, well, they were crazy. Well, as soon as you call them crazy, you've halted the process of trying to understand. And it also, not that you're there, they should be understood, but there was a reason behind what they did. And if you just say it's because they're crazy, then you don't actually find the material. And that goes into professional life. You know, you might say, oh, well, that, you know, that person's crazy. And again, it halts your ability to understand. Yeah. So that was something I learned recently, is nobody's crazy.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you know, taking the practical side of that statement and looking at whatever's happening in a project in Ireland or Puerto Rico or China, where it might seem crazy to me because the way it's done isn't the way I've done it before, right? That I had to catch myself and say, wait a minute, this is normal for this person. Why? And so that's the idea that you're talking about.
Yeah. You mentioned Stephen Covey's books. Are there any other books that you think people that are either in or moving into leadership and management roles should put on their list of books to read?
Yeah, so a couple from Patrick Lencioni.
I got them all. Yeah.
So there's one called The Advantage that we have used in our company to write a playbook. And at the end of this, I'll try to leave you with one of the statements from the playbook that I think is really important. But his book, The Advantage, is about, you know, finding a purpose or a meaning in what you're doing, and then getting everybody aligned to that. That's one. Another one by him that I just recently read, and I think it's a newer book, is called The 6 Types of Working Genius.
Yep. That just came out. I tried to, I heard about it. He gave a speech to my Vistage group, which is a CEO advisory group. And I was like, and he talked about it. I was like, awesome. And I went to order it and it wasn't ready yet. So yeah, that's a new one for sure.
I've read it. I would recommend it. That one's about finding the right roles for the right people.
RPRS.
So it's right. So it's all of us have one or two things that we're kind of genius about. And we've got a couple things that we're probably not so good at. And then some that are in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find yourself working on the things that you're really good at or the things in the middle. And you might find yourselves getting bored or frustrated if you're not aligned to the things that you're really a genius in. And if you don't have people that fill all the other spots, your team doesn't perform well. And so that's the concept of his book. And I think it's a pretty easy thing to read. You know, Patrick usually has some kind of a story or a fable that gets surrounded the idea that he, and then he talks about the management or the leadership idea. So that's a book I'd recommend to people.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think this has been a really good conversation. I was excited to kind of hear more about your background and how you've evolved and your perspective on leadership and management. What final thoughts would you give on that topic to the people listening?
Yeah, so I think no matter what you're doing in your work, no matter which company you're at, it helps to have a central kind of value statement or a reason for existing. And so I want to share what we've worked on at our company. And for me, it's kind of connected to my heart and what I've done with my life as well. So it's this idea of being a trusted solution for our clients so that we're trying to solve a problem for them, not just do the thing they asked. And that's what being trusted is. But the real goal and the real purpose of that is to improve the human experience. So make life better and make the world a better place, build a better working world is what we say. And so those two ideas of making the human experience better and making the world a better place are a part of our mission. And yeah, you might say that's kind of generic, and it is, except that the things I chose to do in my life that were related to life science work all through Lilly and now at CAI, they were really about that core belief that let's take care of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make life better for other people. And so I'd encourage people to find work that does something like that for themselves. So that puts a passion into your work and puts a spring into your step. And that's what I'd leave.
Awesome. Well, I would say that great minds think alike, if I could be so bold. So we implemented EOS and the Entrepreneurial Operating System, and they have a whole library of books that you have to read, and a big portion of that is Patrick Lencioni books, and so that's why I'm very familiar with him. And when we were coming with up with our, and I'll reference Simon Sinek's why, you know, what is your purpose? They had a very unique way of identifying our purpose as an organization. And the implementer said, Nick, do you ever get a case of the Mondays? And I said, no, actually I don't. And he said, why?
Yeah.
And what followed was our purpose, which is, I knew every day I was waking up, we were making a positive impact on the people that we were interacting with. And first and foremost, again, I kind of subscribe to Virgin CEO's perspective, which is, clients don't come first, employees come first. You take care of your employees and they're going to take care of your clients. So knowing that they're happy, and I'm sure you've seen the same thing. Somebody buys a vacation home, or they go on a trip, or they got, they went on a vacation or whatever. They funded their kids, college tuition. It just makes you feel really good because that your organization had a part in what they were able to accomplish. And if you hadn't set up that entity or helped make it function correctly, then they couldn't become the person that they became.
Absolutely.
So that's, I definitely subscribe to that. So, awesome. Well, Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. This was really great. And as always, for everybody listening, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with your colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow us on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect, feel free to go on LinkedIn and connect with me personally. So much good content. So thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next time.
Thanks, man.